So last week, we went to the book of Acts, and I tried to talk to us a little bit theologically, philosophically, about some things with one eye to the future of Westwood Heights. And I wanted to come back and revisit that subject tonight. And, you know, there is nothing impending, at least not that I'm aware of in my life. But it's the end of the year. It is my 60th year. It is my 33rd year here in ministry. And, you know, we want to be mindful that the clock is racing forward and never backwards. And so we talked about some things that are biblical mandates for the church. And I just want to come back and maybe talk to us a little bit more pragmatically this evening, if I can do that. And I realize that what I'm doing this evening is not going to be highly expositional. I understand that. So, you know, to help put your mind at ease, next week, the 27th, we're going to begin to work our way through the book of Numbers. And my guess is that in the not terribly distant future, we'll be glad to be able to look back on services like this as we work our way through the many lists in that book. I'm aware, and I mentioned, you know, the only absolute concrete plan that I have with reference to our life in ministry is that when the school year ends in May of 2023, at this point in time, I absolutely plan for that to be my last year teaching in the academy. That's the only definitive plan I have, and I'm not going to go back over all the disclaimers. They're very real, and the Lord has his own mind, and predicting the future is, from a human standpoint, a little bit of a fool's errand. I'm not trying to predict the future, and I certainly am not trying to control it, and I'm not even incredibly troubled, but I do want to have the mindset. Two times in the book of Proverbs, the proverb is repeated virtually word for word. The prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. And so there is, I think, some value in looking where the sensitive spots are, so that we can pray specifically about those things, talk to the Lord specifically about those things, and anticipate what shape those things might look like. So that's really my only goal. It is not to create a scene of, you know, any kind of a scene of panic, or, and which I don't think you would take away, but you might walk away and think, you know, he's painted a pretty, you know, gloomy picture about some things, and it's not my intention to do that either. I came to this passage because it is a passage that talks about people who are looking at the same event, apparently from a little bit different perspectives. Of course, Ezra chronologically is almost at the very end of the Old Testament. Ezra probably, the events of Malachi follow it. But otherwise, it is at the very end of the Old Testament. It is after the exile. The Jews have been allowed to return, and the temple is rebuilt. And we're getting ready to start working our way through the book of Ezra and Nehemiah on Sunday mornings, and I don't want to try and explore all of that. I would point out that there are at least three themes that are going on in this little section, and one of those is continuity. They are rebuilding the temple. They are not devising a new form of religion. They're not inventing a new religion. They're not innovating. Sometimes this passage is used to contrast the old style and the new style, but that is really not what is going on here. This is a passage that clearly describes continuity. The temple is not the same in its dimensions, but everything else is the same. Same temple, same God, same way of worshiping. So continuity is a clear theme here. The other theme that emerges is that of memory. We have a group of men that our Bibles call ancient, the ancient men. And these are men who could remember what it was like when they ministered in Solomon's temple. That temple was destroyed 70 years prior. These are old men. I mean, the temple's been gone 70 years. If they were a child, if they were an adolescent when it came down, they're still an old man. They are truly ancient. The text really does not clearly articulate the nature of their tears. Are they tears of joy? Are they tears of lament? Are they crying because the old temple just isn't quite as good as the new temple? Or are they crying because at long last the temple is rebuilt? What is clear, and I think, by the way, that you could make the argument that if these are tears of lamentation, they should have been shed a long time ago. Right? Maybe had there been a group of people crying over the condition of the temple 100 years ago, the temple wouldn't have come down 70 years ago. That's neither here nor there for our standpoint. The third theme that emerges is one of emotion. Nobody is indifferent to what's happening. Nobody is indifferent. At least, if anybody is indifferent, God does not tell us about them. God tells us about noise of shouting and weeping and rejoicing at what is going on. So I don't think that it's a stretch for any church to look at this period and these events and to try and call some lessons from them, to think about them. So what I want to do this evening is twofold. First of all, I just want to talk to us about some of the challenges we possibly face, challenges that I see coming to us. And then secondly, to talk about attitudes that we must have. Attitudes that we must have. So so let me just talk first of all then about the issues that we might face. And again, I will take the time to make this disclaimer. I am talking to us from the perspective that Westwood Heights is going to continue to be a very conservative, Bible-believing Baptist church government, dispensational view of interpret of the scriptures, premillennial, pre-tribulational. This is going to be the perspective that we carry on into the future. In other words, I'm operating on the assumption that if somebody wanted to come in and make it a liberal church, you would not stay. That if somebody wanted to come in and make it a charismatic church, you would not stay. So we're not going to talk about that. I would stipulate further that we're probably not all going to agree with or be happy with what conservative looks like going out into the future. I realize that as well. Conservative to one generation might not be conservative to another generation, and that's a very real thing. I'm not trying to make light of that or minimize that in any way. But my perspective is that we will continue to be a conservative, Bible-believing church out into the future. So I say all of that to say, you know, issues we face. Well, we could go liberal. Somebody could try and take it charismatic. You know, I mean, I realize all of those kinds of crazy things. So let me just walk quickly through the list of things that I think subsequent generations might have to or are most certainly going to have to at some level to deal with. One of them is the actual physical location of our building. We were constituted as a church in 1972, I think. And the church that was then met in a rented facility at 88th and Center for a while, and they were able to buy this building, which had been built as kind of sort of a Methodist church. It was actually built as a United Evangelical Brethren building. The original building was about 4,000 square feet. If you look very carefully, right back there, you can still see the shape of where the doors were to the original building, where you came into the sanctuary. And we have, of course, gone through a number of building additions, pretty big ones in 1990, 1993, 1999, 2000. You know, the biggest one, the multipurpose building in 1999, we built the garage. We've been through a lot of things. Always we have stayed in this location. In 1995, we had serious, serious discussions about relocating the ministry. There was a piece of property that was available at Millard Avenue and Harrison Street. Obviously, we're in the middle of a residential section, and when this church was built, being in a residential section was totally acceptable for churches. And one of the advantages to being in a residential section, apart from the mentality that churches have ministry to residences, is the fact that residential land is generally less expensive than commercial land. Somewhere in the past, Douglas County changed the statute, and churches cannot operate in Douglas County on residential land. They now have to be on commercially zoned or industrially zoned real estate. And one of the advantages to moving down to Highway 50 was that it was actually going to put us in Sarpy County, just barely, and Sarpy County still allowed churches to go into residential land. But it was never ugly, any of our meetings. But the most divided that we have ever been on any issue that I can ever remember as a church was over relocating in the mid-1990s. And we were about divided three ways on that. A third of the people didn't want to move anywhere. About a third of the people wanted to move to the land on Highway 50 and Harrison. And about a third of the people wanted to move, but someplace else. And we couldn't get a consensus. And we finally just let the thing die. And we have been here ever since. But the neighborhood is changing, not becoming a bad neighborhood, but certainly becoming a different neighborhood. And if there's going to be any future expansion, we're going to have to buy a lot of houses. And there is a large cost to that. There are seven properties that border us on the east side that if we really wanted to expand the land, we would need to buy all seven. That's about $1 million purchase just for the land. So, again, is this a reason to panic? Is it a reason to sit up nights? No. It's vain for us to rise up early and to sit up late and to eat the bread of sorrows. These are things that belong to the Lord. But they are decisions that might have to be made and that might have to be addressed. And so when we talk about, you know, renovating, which we do periodically, or expanding, or this building project or that building project, these are parts of the equation that always come in. And one of the advantages of, we're obviously pretty centrally located. We're relatively close to the interstate. That's a good thing. One of the disadvantages is almost nobody drives by and sees us. We're kind of tucked away. People who are looking for us find us. Usually they do. In addition to everything else, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but Pedersen Drive goes from 120th, where it starts heading west, and when you come in off of 120th, you have east-west addresses, and then it curves. And when it does that, the city gave us north-south addresses, and it goes up to Westwood Lane, and that's about all the Pedersen Drive that you'll find anywhere in town. And so it's, you know, if you start trying to explain it to somebody, fortunately we live in the days of GPS, but back in the old days when you tried to explain it to somebody, it was pretty hard to give them any kind of a strong geographical reference because they can't find Pedersen Drive anywhere but here. Anyway. So that's, like I said, is it a big deal? Maybe not. Is it an issue right now? It is not an issue right now. If we wanted to undertake another $500,000 or $1 million building project, I think it was something that we would have to seriously have a conversation about. Are we content to do what we would need to do to remain here as long as, you know, the church is going to be what the church is going to be. All right? Secondly, so the location of our facility is one issue, and in many ways the most minor of those issues. Secondly, the other thing would be what I would call the nature of our ministries. Whenever we talk about ministries, and I think I've made my case known that I agree with. I heard a man say that he was convinced the American church is hopelessly addicted to programs, and I agree with him 100%. It is almost impossible for people, especially people of my generation, to think of church in any other way than a collection of programs. And the way you build a church is to multiply programs. And you offer more programs, and you do more things, and therefore you have more ministries. And we do and say those things without really, I think, in many ways, ever giving. I'm not saying you, I'm saying we, preachers. We do those things, and we lead those things, and we promote those things, it seems to me, with almost giving no thought whatsoever as to whether or not that's what the Bible really means when it talks about ministry. However, having said that, we do have ministries, programmatic ministries. And we do have a mandate to minister to the people of God. And ministry, I don't want to get too far off on this, but there is really, folks, and I'm not trying to split a hair here, and I'm not trying to be a crackpot, but there is genuinely, biblically, no such thing as ministry to lost people. Ministry is to saved people. You evangelize the lost. You minister to the saved. And Hebrews 6:10, God is not unrighteous to forget your work and labor of love which ye have showed toward his name, and that ye have ministered to the saints. And do minister. And Paul said about his own evangelistic efforts, therefore I endure all things for the elect's sake. He wasn't doing it for lost people. He was doing it for saved people. And you cannot minister without having people who do ministry and people who receive ministry. Now, like I said, my generation tends to be very program institutional oriented. We want programs, we want classrooms, we want organization, we want attendance lists, we want teachers, we want curriculum, we want a system, we want a structure. And sometimes, folks, there can be no other way. What would the song service have looked like tonight if Brother Tony had gotten up and said, grab your hymnal and turn to your favorite hymn, and the piano is going to play a C, and the organ is going to play a G, and at the count of three, everybody starts singing your favorite song. I don't think any of us would count that as having been a great song service. So obviously there are times and places in which you need some organization and some structure. I'm not opposed to that. I'm just saying that biblically that is not the end of ministry. I haven't fulfilled my biblical obligation to minister to the people of God because I participated in a program. Let me put it that way. But anytime you do have a ministry, you need some structure and you need human leadership. In the 21st century, that means you've got to have a coherent idea about technology. I'm not saying everybody has to use it, but we have to talk through it and think through it and decide what to do with it or where to abandon it. We are still, in many ways, a paper and pencil ministry. And increasingly, the younger generation and the millennials get a lot of bashing, but you do know that the millennials are not the newest generation. The newest generation is now younger than the millennials, and they are the Z generation. And these are not paper and pencil people. So I am more than content, and I understand and sympathize that we need to have conversations about this and they are awkward. But I think the reality is that we are going to have to utilize technology. And if some of us are dragged into the technological world kicking and screaming, the next generation is going to take it I mean, look, I have 10 grandchildren. 9 of them have been born. 1 is on the way. I have a 2-year-old grandson who picks up a telephone and points it at the television and starts pushing buttons. And he expects things to happen when he does. And I got a Snapchat of him the other day. He had a tablet out. He had found some game on it, and it was speaking Russian to him. It was giving him game instructions in Russian. But that's okay. If you heard him jibber-jabber, he speaks Russian. So I'm not terribly concerned about that. But when you have grown up, when you have grown up in that world, when you have grown up with a cell phone in your hand and a tablet in your hand and the electronic world at your hand, you are just going to think differently about that. So the role and place of technology is one of those things that, you know, I appreciate apprehensions, but we need to make sure that we're thinking about them biblically and reacting and responding and making our decisions biblically. Another place is the academy. And the bottom line is, and I really do, I apologize to you and I feel bad because I feel like in retrospect, I've kind of come to the pulpit and complained so many times about things that it has flavored anything that I would say about the academy. So this has nothing to do with me. The reality is that the future of the academy is in the hands of the parents of our younger children. Is it not? And if they wish to do other things in the role of educating their children, then the church is going to have to decide whether it wants to continue to operate a Christian school. I mean, that's just the bottom line. I mean, it's just, should we sit up nights and worry about it? Absolutely not. Should we be cognizant of the fact that one of these days we may have to answer the question, do we really want to have a school if the people in our own church don't want it? I think you're going to have to answer that question. And I don't know. And I met a few weeks ago with the young adults, you know, who are, you know, have young children or will have young children. And, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty, but there was very little. We have absolutely positively got to maintain Omaha Baptist Academy, and that's the end of the conversation. So that's where it is. And as always, folks, okay, I mean, any of these things require 3 things. They require the consent of the church, the involvement of people in operating the ministry, and the participation of those who are receiving the ministry. So no school can function if the church doesn't want it. But no matter how badly the church wants it, it can't have it if there are no students. And no matter how bad the church and the students want it, they can't have it if there's no faculty. And faculty is going to become an ever-increasing issue. We have built a school around the philosophy of virtually robbing housewives of income because their husbands can afford for them to work for virtually nothing. If the day comes, we don't operate it as a moneymaker for the ministry because the church puts $700 a week into the school to pay the pittance salaries that we pay. No apologies for that. That's the structure. Everybody knows what they're getting into when they go into this. But if we reached a place where we had to pay a teacher even a reasonable wage, then you're going to have to figure out how to finance that. And you're going to have to figure out then if that gives you... I mean, the reality is, folks, that the competitive edge that we've always offered is an incredibly low-cost, decent academic education. No frills, no bells, no whistles. You learn to read, write, and count. That's what you get. And that's what we do, and that's what we've done for 30 years, and over 30 years, and if I can say, and I would say, we've done that fairly well. Our kids graduate high school, they do well in college, they pass out of bonehead English, they're competent in that, but everything else falls upon the parents to get done. We don't do music, we don't do athletics, we don't do fine arts, we reading, writing, arithmetic, that's what we do. So another issue along these lines is going to be the future of the choir. I mean, for how many years has it been, Steve? 18? How long have you guys been here? 18, 19 years? So, right, one of these days, the Andersons are probably going to retire, and then we're going to have to decide what to do and what that is going to look like. And we're talking about that again. I mean, this is not a sit up late and, you know, rise up early and walk around in a panic and sweat about it, but it is an issue, and it's one that is going to have to be answered. And what will the choir look like then? And then, of course, there is me. And, you know, again, one of these days, it is going to be the best thing to happen to Westwood Heights for me to retire or to resign or maybe just run away. I don't know. I think of myself as having the three R's options, and on any given day, it would be resign, retire, or run away, and you'll have to figure out what that is. I wonder about this seriously, and I've already mentioned this, if we should not, in the not terribly distant future, entertain the thought of bringing on an assistant pastor, certainly not because I am overworked, because I am not in any way overworked, but with a view to that. There are so many places where the Lord has given us such depth of ministry. And this, I think, is one of the weaker links. And in saying that, I mean no criticism of any of the guys that fill in for me. I do this. I get paid to do this every day. I understand what it takes. I really do. I understand what it takes, the commitment of time and study that it takes to bring something that is relatively coherent. So I just can't dump that on the guys of the church on a regular basis. Guys who have children and families and are working 40 or 50 or 60 hours a week, and then dump that on them on a regular basis. So anyway, that's just something there. I assume that we will continue on with the formats that we follow. We'll have nursery, and you know, I mean, we're not one of those that have a philosophy that everybody has to be in the auditorium all the time, all together. We'll have nursery, we'll have a variety of Sunday school classes. I've already made mention of, and I've had some feedback, you know, perhaps it is time or thinking about time to begin looking again at having children's church. We had put an end to it. I don't know that we have a lot of children that age, but it may be something to think about. So, and when we do those things, then you've got to have workers, right? I mean, you know, and I think by now that many of you know what my answer is to these kinds of things. Why don't we do this? Why don't we do this? Why don't we do this? Shouldn't we do something like this? And I pretty much always ask the same question. Will you do it? Because, and I'm not trying to be ugly and I'm not trying to be snarky, but I have a job. And I am not overworked, but it wouldn't take very much if I tried to oversee this program and run that program and get this done and get that done, that I would feel overworked, and I'm an old man and I'm crabby and I don't want to go there. So, here's something, and this is, I'm just kind of inserting this in here, but when this thing is broached, I never really think that it's going to be an issue with the younger generation, and I always expect that it's going to be a fight with the older generation. Most insurance carriers, and ours is one, they regularly suggest, and they strongly suggest, that we need to submit all of our church workers to a criminal background check. And that is the world in which we live. And so I'll just throw this out. I don't want your answer right now, but what do you think about that? What do you think about, I would like to be in the nursery. I would like to work in the nursery. You have to submit to a criminal background check. It's kind of the world as it is. And again, a lot of people think that these are good things, beneficial things. And some of us, I think, you know, we just wonder how far we want the outside to reach in. And again, so these are not insurmountable issues. They may never become issues at all. Look, we have seen this time and time again. I have watched time and time again. The Lord is not in the habit, folks, of raising up answers to hypothetical questions. God is in the habit of solving very real problems. So when the need really arises, then God is inclined to act. So I'm talking about these things. Again, I'm not trying to paint a bleak picture. You know, the sky is not falling. This is a drill. You know, this is not a real life scenario. And we may never answer these. I mean, the Lord may just boom, boom, boom. And so who knows? So those are just some of the issues that I think about large issues, things that potentially we might have to address. Those are some of the issues that we face. Let me transition now into the attitude that we must have. The enduring legacy of Pentecost is, I would propose, one mind. One mind. I mean, obviously the gospel is preached, people are saved, disciples are made, the Great Commission is being fulfilled. And here's why I say that. Romans. Let me just run through these verses very quickly. Romans 12:16. Be of the same mind toward one another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estates. Be not wise in your own conceits. Romans 15:6. That ye may with one mind and one mouth glorify God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. 1 Corinthians 1:10. Now I beseech you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that ye all speak the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, but that ye be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. 2 Corinthians 13:11. Finally, brethren, farewell. Be perfect, be of good comfort, be of one mind, live in peace, and the God of love and peace shall be with you. Philippians 1:27. Only let your conversation be as it becometh the gospel of Christ, that whether I come and see you or else be absent, I may hear of your affairs, that ye stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. Philippians 2:2, fulfill ye my joy that ye be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. 1 Peter 3:8, finally be ye all of one mind, having compassion one of another, love as brethren, be pitiful, be courteous. Now, again, one mind is not we all eat cheeseburgers on Friday and fish on Sunday, and we all like vanilla and we all hate nuts on our ice cream. One mind is one mind concerning the things of God. One desire to glorify God. One mind cannot be, folks, one personality, because we have different personalities by creation. One mind cannot be the same gifts, because we have different gifts by personality. And one mind cannot even be the same practice, because Romans 14 is very clear that we can have the same mind about the Lord, and yet one of us eat meat and one of us not eat meat. So you've got to qualify what the one mind means. And so what we want is one mind that is desirous to serve the Lord in a way that glorifies Him, and we glorify Him by being obedient to the Bible from our hearts. Turn, if you would, to Titus chapter 2. I would encourage you to pray for this. And this, of course, is going to be the work of the Spirit. It was the work of the Spirit at Pentecost. I think that was the point. The Spirit of God worked in such a way that the people were of one mind. Again, I don't think that that meant you could walk around the 5,000 men and probably 5,000 more women and however many children and everybody liked the same TV show. But the unity of mind was unity of mind concerning the things of the Lord. Titus chapter 2. But speak thou the things which become sound doctrine, that the aged men be sober, grave, temperate, sound in faith, in charity, in patience. The aged women likewise, that they be in behavior as becometh holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. Young men likewise exhort to be sober-minded, in all things showing thyself a pattern of good works, in doctrine showing uncorruptness, gravity, sincerity, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that he that is of the contrary part may be ashamed, having no evil thing to say of you. So, with that as the text, let me just make a couple of comments in closing. To the older generation, whoever is the older generation, we cannot hold the young people in contempt. And I think the truth of the matter is that sometimes we do. They want to do things differently. They see things differently. And we are angry. And we say things like, they're not as committed as we are. And it was different when we were young. And it's true. It's true. My father was a product of the Depression. I was not. There was nothing that he could do about being a product of the Depression. There's nothing that I could do about not being a product of the Depression. I'm a baby boomer. I didn't pick being a baby boomer. If you're a millennial, you didn't pick being a millennial. If you're Generation Z, you didn't pick that. We all have a responsibility to live obediently before the Lord. My parents were poorer than I was growing up. I was poorer than my children were growing up. And my children were poorer than their children were growing up. Those are just facts. Those are just facts. We view some of these young people as spoiled. Our parents viewed us as spoiled. And sometimes we say, well, they're not as committed. But we didn't wake up at the ripe old age of 20 and become committed. We became committed by investing our time and our lives and our money in something. And over the course of time, we realized that we were committed. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Neither can we always keep parenting them as if they are incompetent. And so if I have not made it clear, I want to make it abundantly clear that one of the things I greatly desire to see at Westwood Heights is the incorporation of younger, faithful people into the decision-making process and leadership roles of the ministry. And not always... And I'm not saying that you do that, but I periodically, you know, it just seems like it comes out that way. Right? That they're just kids and they don't really know what they're doing and they don't know what they're talking about, and if they get their way, it's going to be a colossal disaster. Probably so. But we're not going to take any time on Wednesday night to go back and revisit the colossal disasters we experienced when we were that age. Part of our task, it seems to me, from the scriptures, is to help them to develop leadership skills, not to deny them that opportunity by pointing out their youth. To the younger generation, whoever that might be, and since the Bible doesn't put an age limit on it, I'm not putting an age limit on it. I'll leave you to figure out where you fit in that. To the younger generation, I recently read a quote. I have a good friend who posts a Spurgeon quote on Twitter every day. He's a Spurgeon expert. And I saw this one a couple of weeks ago, and I just started laughing because I thought of myself. Spurgeon said, "We make great advances on the old folks, do we not? The young men are wonderfully bright and intelligent, and the old people are a good deal behind them. Yes, yes, that is the way we talk before our beards have grown." I still remember, I was 27 years old, I'd been the pastor here about 15 minutes. I'm walking through the building with Roger Canuck, and Roger's with the Lord now, but Roger was big, tall, big, not afraid of anything apparently. We're walking through the building, and somebody had painted, and in the painting, the volunteer painting, they had slop paint everywhere, and I said, "Look at that, that's terrible." And he just looked at me the way Roger could look at you and said, "You weren't here to tell us how to do it." Yes, I guess I wasn't. To those of you who are young, and again, I'm not saying that this is always the case, but I think sometimes it is the case that what you very much want is for the old folks to get out of the way so that you can do things and have things your way. Now, you have to be very careful there because that can be very offensive to people who have, literally, put their lives into a ministry. I know I'm getting old. I have absolutely no patience. I went through this 4 or 5 years ago with a spate of well-intentioned college-age people trying to tell me everything that was wrong with Westwood Heights. Do I think that we are perfect? I do not think we are perfect. Do I think that we are always right? I think that we think we're always right. I don't think that any of us get up in the morning and go, I know this is wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway. But when people have invested their time and their life into something, and then somebody who has not done that comes along and tells them how wrong they are and how quickly they want it to be changed, you cannot really expect that to go over well. And then if I could just be, for just a moment, the pragmatic old man. You know what old people do really well? They write big checks. They write big checks. They just do. I mean, it's 3 minutes late. I can't get into all this, but guys of my generation are looking at their churches, and we all know the same thing. And that is that the older generation, by percentage, more people participate in the giving of the church, and they write bigger checks when they do give. And that's just, whether we like it or not, that's just going to change the way a church looks. So, forgive me if I have a very big soft spot in my heart for the older generation. Not just because of the money. These are the people who built the building and make the thing go. Provided a place for people to come. Taught Sunday school. Taught in the academy. Sang in the choir. And then somebody comes along and goes, yeah, but you're not doing it right. That hurts. That hurts. So tread lightly to those of you who are the younger generation. You have some great ideas. You are right about some things. But you have to be very careful in how you present that. And the Bible, not Ken Largent, the Bible is very clear that you owe them some very serious deference and respect and not contempt because they're old and behind the scenes. Mature leadership is still God's pattern. So I got to wind this down because once again, having made a concerted effort to be done at 7:45, it is now 8 o'clock. Right? Christ will build his church. That is guaranteed. Christ will build his church. That is guaranteed. What those churches will look like, how many of them will exist in local assemblies, the estimates are, and I did a little bit of research, and I'm not trying to do math on this, but the estimates, the conservative estimates, are somewhere that between 8,000 and 12,000 local churches close every year now. They just close the doors and go away. So, will Christ build his church? Yes. Should we want that? Yes. Should we want Westwood Heights to continue? I would certainly hope so. We want it to be conservative, Bible-believing? Yes. That's going to take everybody's effort and cooperation and participation. Okay, with that, I'm going to stop.